about is what you actually learn from looking at the proteins that are known to be membrane proteins. So as we know, there are two types of membrane proteins. One is the alpha helical membrane proteins. These are including bacterial rhodopsins or GPCR. And the other one are these beta membrane proteins. And so the kind of questions I'm interested in is to look at, are there any specific patterns in the structures of these or sequence of these proteins? Are there intrinsic residue preferences for different types of regions in the lipids? And do you find these sequence motifs in the membrane proteins? And the hope is that we might start to look at some of the determinants that will decide the destination when the peptide chains eventually where they end up. Are they going to be incorporated in the membrane or are they going to be pushed through? And the second question I'm interested in to look at is strand interactions. And the idea is that maybe we can look at these information, try to understand maybe there are some molecular determinants about protein folding and assembly in the membrane environment. Of course, the ultimate goal is that hopefully we can predict some three-dimensional structures just from the sequences. And related problems in alpha helical membrane proteins, but I'm going to be mostly focusing on beta barrel membrane proteins. So beta barrel membrane proteins are very important. They are found in the outer membranes of all gram-negative bacteria, and also as well as mitochondria and the chloroplast. And in some cases, they are also found in gram-positive bacteria, and they are found a lot in these exotoxins of bacteria. The problems is that right now we only know about 20 or so such structures, and that is the knowledge base. And the challenging problem is that to develop models so you can actually learn something from such few data, that's a very difficult problem. And these proteins are important because they're responsible for bacterial adhesion, enzyme activities, diffusion of various molecules, transport, and so on and so forth, and they are very important for diseases, various basically anthrax and meningitis, all those diseases have something to do with these proteins. And they are excellent targets for looking for antibacterial drugs as well as for vaccines. So here is the overall architecture of these type of proteins. So they are essentially formed by even number of strands, and they basically twist and tilt into barrel structures. And these strands are formed in anti-parallel fashions. And there are loops extending in the basically outside the membranes. And these are the periplastic plasmic side. So there's another inner membrane. This is outer membrane. And this is the outside, and this is cytosol. So these on this side, the loops are relatively short. There's a lot of proteins. And on this side, the loops are longer. And they can form monomers or oligomers. And the other interesting part of their architecture is that we have a fairly regular orientations of the residues. So they are alternately facing, the side chains of these residues are alternately facing outward, inward, outward, inward. And they form the neighboring strand, form a very strong hydrogen bond. So you could draw those lines, like this residue forms a hydrogen bond to here, and all the way up. And because it wraps around itself, forms a barrel, so this strand is exactly the same strand here. But you can see the hydrogen bonds forms a shift from the starting position, and that is the Shiri number that people use to describe these protein structures.
Sort of
yeah.
Silly question, but maybe this is answering it. Is there like a channel or a pore down the middle, or is it all filled in?
That's what this protein does. These protein does. They wrap around and forms channels, but depending on the residue inside, they have very different selectivities and all sorts of important things they do.
Okay. So it could be for ions or for other molecules as well?
Yeah.
Or mostly ion channels?
It's ions and the other stuff. So some of these functions are unknown, actually. So there's a lot to be studied. But essentially, we can look at the different regions of these proteins they basically sense. And we can divide this into external cap region and periplasmic cap regions, as well as these head group regions and the hydrophobic transmembrane core regions. And this is following Wimley's definition a few years back.
And they come in different radii?
So here is what we know. These are basically non-homologous beta-barrel membrane proteins, 18 of them. They And then some of them have a huge number of strands, 22. Some of them are very small, so they have a different radii for sure. And some of them form trimer, some of them form dimer, and some of them are just happy to be monomerized. So the first question we look at is the residue preference for this region. So essentially, here's what we have. We look at the residues. They are alternating as internal residues and external residues. So the question we ask is that can we look at each individual type of residues, do they prefer in these cap regions or head group regions or core regions? And the way to do this is very simple. You look at, basically, assume a model that all these protein structures are sampled with equal probability, and then you just count the frequency of appearance of these type of residues in bigger regions. And you compare this with the expected frequency of some null model, and then you can know whether there's a strong preference for this residue one way or the other. But
is external and internal relative to the cytoplasm of the cell or relative to
the
inner
barrel.
Out of the membrane?
So, they form a barrel.
Oh, it's barrel. Okay.
So they're sticking to the side or sticking outside.
Outside.
Exactly.
Thanks.
Yeah.
So this is only within the residues that form the barrel.
Exactly. So I'm only talking about transmembrane part of the protein. So, but the key issue here is what is your null model? And that's very important. And remember, the problem we're dealing with is very small number of structures. So the choices of statistical model is very important. So in this case, what we decided to do is to use a very intuitive model. So essentially, we exhaustively permute all residues in all these regions. And then each permutation occurs with equal probability. And then in this case, the null model gives you a probability that a particular type of residue appear in this R region, appearing I number of times is just a hypergeometric distribution. And with this, then we can start to calculate p-values, because then you can sum up all the occurrence of the probability of various count up to some count. So this is the basic idea. So we start to look at the distribution, and we calculate p-values. So the results look like this. If you look at these residues, you find out that two obvious part of the aromatic residues, what's called aromatic girdles, show up in the transmembrane regions. And these are basically enriched with trypsins and tyrosines. And people know about this for a very long time. And then you also see in the interior, internal facing residues, meaning residues facing the internal of the barrels, actually, there's no difference between head group and core, and they're all enriched with these polar residues or charged residues. But one interesting thing you look at this is that look at the loop regions, the head group region, sorry. And in this case, you find that there's in the extracellular cap region versus the periplasmic cap region, there's a very different distribution for the basic residues. Here, you see a lot of more these basically charged residues. And this is a new result. No one knew about this before. And this is very important because if you look at the helical membrane proteins, there's an opposite rules. That is, positive charged residues are inside the membrane. But we found for beta barrel membrane proteins, the opposite. And this rule is so important because it's the most important determinant dictates where the membrane protein, whether it's going to be flipped this way or the other way. And there's a lot of work done by von Hein, who was the first one proposed this rule about 20 years ago. And recently, they published a very nice paper. So basically, you can change the distribution of the residues in the membrane by making mutations that you can basically control whether the membrane is facing this way or flipped. And that's very well studied. And so we found, basically, these basic residues might play similar roles for beta barrel membrane proteins, but in an opposite way. And we started, after we found this, we knew nothing about the lipid environment of this beta barrel membrane protein, so we started looking for literatures. And it turns out that one of the possible reasons is probably due to these asymmetric distribution of lipids in these membranes. Because in the inner leaflet, you have a lot of PEs, but on the outer leaflet, you have a lot of LPS. And these have a lot of negatively charged residues. So one of the interesting we can do is that we can generate a lot of perhaps useful hypotheses. So the question is that maybe these residues are determinants in somewhat about the membrane insertions. So because of the different affinity of these two sides of the barrels for the lipids, and then there might be even a possibility that this LPS might co-inserting with the proteins into membranes. So this certainly could suggest that some experiments to be done to check these possible.
So that I get this right, so you're saying that in contrast to animal cells, inside is basically negatively charged,
yeah.
And interior is the outside.
Exactly.
Therefore, it's flipped the other way around.
Yeah. So it's not just animal, it's the reference is alpha helical membrane proteins. That's the other huge dominating class of membrane proteins. They appear in animals and the other in bacteria as well.
But where is this protein in the bacteria? It's not in its membrane where it was created.
It's in the outer membrane.
It's in the outer membrane, not
right.
The inner membrane.
Not in the inner membrane.
Right, so it's not performing a function in a lipid bilayer.
It is performing a function
in the outer lipid bilayer.
Right.
No. So then when that gets incorporated into our red cell membranes, it causes a bleed or something.
In bacteria, it'll do things.
Yeah, but the bacteria is now interacting with a host in a parasitic way or a pathological way.
Yeah.
And that channel now goes into our membranes with a negative charge on the inside. In the red cell membrane, the PS is on the inside.
Right. These are all barrel proteins in outer membrane of what Gram's negative.
But they're not the pathological to others?
Yeah, they are pathological to others. So the other question we want to look at is how these strains are interacting with each other. And there's a very it's a very well known nice model for beta barrel beta proteins in general. And essentially, you can look at the three important interaction forces. One is the strong hydrogen bond. Basically, these are the backbone. Oxygen and nitrogen, strong hydrogen bond. And then you can look at these non-hydrogen bond interactions, essentially the side chain groups. And the third one is this very weak hydrogen bond formed here. So that's the model we use. And again, what we're trying to do is perhaps developing some kind of interaction parameters, some kind of empirical force field. That is how much one residue likes to interact with this other residue in this particular type of interaction. So again, the idea is very simple. You assume some statistical model, and then you look at count the number of turns in the known structured database. You compare this with some null model. And in this case, the null model is that these two adjacent strands are permuted exhaustively, and each permutation is equally likely. And the problem of the study is that these strands are relatively short, so you cannot use these chi-square distribution simple model to approximate. You really have to look at because they are so short and there's a lot of coupling effects. So here's just a very simple example. What you can see is if I want to look for AY contact, AY, then what I do is I basically permute this strand with all possible widths, and I count how many of them actually appears, and that's my null model. So the probability, if all the two residues are of the same types, it turns out it to be, again, a hypergeometric distributions. And now you can sum this all up with different strand pairs in your structures of database. And then you can calculate the expected value. And that's the one we used to calculate the propensity. That's the null model of expected value. And because we're able to calculate probability of occurrence of these I number of contacts, that we can calculate p-value. And that's really critically important for us to say, given so little data, which one is really important to significant. So essentially, why this hypergeometric model, it's basically, so I'll skip this. Basically, if you think about this a little bit, then it's obvious. But things get more complicated when you have residues that are a little different. So the expected value can be computed easily, but the p-value is more difficult because essentially what we're encountering is that we have X residue on the first strand, Y residue on the second strand, as well as Y residue on the first strand and X residue on the second strand. And these are coupled. And if you want to calculate p-values, it's not so easy. So it turns out we have to invent some distribution. We don't know what to call it. We call it generalized hypergeometric distribution. So the starting point is, let's look at the trinomial distributions. And we define some function based on these. And then it turns out, if you look at these, the random probability of you have H number of XX contacts, I number of XY contact, J number of YX contact, and K number of Y contact is a messy a function like this. But what you're really looking at is the marginal probability of just XY. You don't care about YY and XX. And you can do this by this using this summation equation. And with this, then we can look at what are the important spatial patterns or residues that are like to interact across the adjacent strands. And I have two types of patterns. One are in these red color, and these are what we call motifs. So essentially, you can see glycine and tyrosine have a strong propensity to interact. And this is all at a p-value of 0.05. But these purple patterns are what we call on this side. Sorry, this is the motifs, and this is more stronger statistical significance. And these are 10% probably not so important. But on the second tunnel, and these are low propensity pairs, what we call anti-motifs. So these guys do not like to be with each other, and it's more so than you would expect it if things are random. So one example, very interesting example, is what we find is that in the internal facing residues, and tyrosine and glycine really have a very strong propensity to interact with a very significant p-values. And this is very interesting because normally in the internal of flavarols, tyrosine is disfavored. And furthermore, if you look at these conformations, 60% of them take a specific side chain conformation. We call this 60-90 rotamers, which is very unfavorable in soluble beta strands. And what is the reason for this thing? And it turns out there was some nice work done by people looking at protein chemistry some years ago in soluble proteins. And it turns out for soluble barrel proteins folding, and this aromatic rescue, what they call it, is very important for the stability of these residues. And that is, if you change a mutated way, you basically you may reduce the stability of the proteins. And if there are multiple places, you might cause this protein not to fold. And so the rationale is probably these covering of this glycine by tyrosine prevents these unfavorable backbone exposure to solvent, and allow this glycine to accommodate these curvatures of these barrel proteins because it has no side chains. And it turns out that this is a very general pattern that we see actually in other types of residue like glycine and phenylalanines. It doesn't have to be tyrosine. And there are also other patterns of non-hydrogen bonding interactions. And in this case, we find, for example, trypsin and tyrosine side chains, and they are very much likely to be interacting if they are in adjacent strands. And also, they take these very interesting conformations, and that probably explain to a very important observation made by Campbell and Bo here at UCLA some time ago. And they looked at rotamers, and these tyrosines and tryptophan have all different rotamer preference. That's essentially the side chain conformations for beta paramembrane proteins versus alpha helical membrane proteins and soluble proteins. There's also
that combination. Can you go back to that?
Sure.
Are you saying that in that combination on the outer edge, is that what gives it? Helps it form its structure then? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's we believe these are interactions is somehow energetically favorable in this case, yeah. Yeah.
So you're estimating these probabilities by comparing to a null model where you just shuffle
within the strand.
So that means that model, you're sort of assuming that there are no kind of correlations with adjacent residues, right?
Right.
And it could be that what kind of contacts it likes to form depends on what things are next to it in the same strand.
Right.
Right? You wouldn't be able to see that.
No, I will be, because I fixed the composition of the residues in the adjacent strand. I just shuffled permeable and exhaustive. So the residue composition is the same.
But exactly what the neighbors are. Like say,
right.
You know, I prefer to make one type of contact if I have A and B as neighbors, but not in another case.
Yeah.
right? You couldn't see that.
That's what I want to find out. That's this statistical model is aimed to discover. So the null model is there's no preference for this type of pairing. And if I see anything deviates from the null model.
Right, but I'm not talking about, okay, so you make a pair between X and Y,
right?
But maybe the propensity to make that depends on the other neighbors to X in its strand.
No, it's,
right?
It's for beta parameter protein, it's, they are like sequence neighbors. They form, they are basically the loop region, one of the pictures I showed in the other end. Loop is very short. So it's always the sequence neighbors interacting with each other.
Right, but you're only able to look at the interaction of one pair, right? And other neighbors, you can't see any dependence on other neighbors, right? Other than the two you're looking at.
Yeah.
In some sense, this is like the analog of liquid theory, the pair correlation function. You take the density, you divide out the ideal gas. What you're asking for is a free form.
Right, yeah. It's exactly the same.
Yes.
So my reference state is your ideal gas model, essentially. But it's very important, depending on how you choose the reference state, because it makes a huge difference.
The tryptophan is also there for anchoring purposes, right? It is located at the head group region.
Yeah,
so
the girdle, yes. So another thing, very interesting observation is that it turns out the chirality plays a great role here. So essentially, if you look at the strands, we define, say, for example, upstrand, and that's going from N to C, it's going up. And then because of all the amino acids are L, chiralities, and the side chains, then you can start to look at the side chain interactions. And if it's on the right, then it's always going to be internal facing. And if it's on the left, it's always going to be external facing. And if it's strong hydrogen bond, then it will be the opposite. And that's very helpful. It reduces our search space by one half. And it took a while for us to realize this. So the third thing we looked at is look at these sequence motifs. And that's very interesting. There's a history of a great accomplishment in the studies of helical membrane proteins, primarily by Sinas, Gerstin, and Engelmann some time ago. What they did is basically look at all the genomic sequences of membrane proteins, and they look for patterns like this, GXXXG. So these are what they call GA4 patterns. Or so basically, it's a G and residue, and that's glycine and alanine with three residues in them. And that pattern appears more often than you would expect it. And it turns out that this is a very important structure to make these membranes assemble. So if you change these patterns, then you will have paid a thermodynamic prices in many cases. So the problem can be formulated in the following. Given you a set of the helices, and can you identify this type of motifs? So again, it's the same model. You look at frequencies, compare this with some null model in this case. And this is easier to work with because we're not talking about sequences, so you have tons of data. So in this case, we have 15,000 of these strand sequences. They're very short, but we have lots of them. So the for this K, that is the residue between them, if there's one, and then we can look at the probability. And so the method, the Sinas and Engelmann and Gerstin, what they used was they basically used enumeration. They used computer to count this. They didn't, but we thought we could do better. We can get a closed forms in many cases. So it turns out if K equals one, you get a hypergeometric distribution, and that's not entirely trivial. So you can think about those problems. You're taking M number of A residues and N number of Y residues in a strand with, let's say, L number of residues. So you look at the probability, for instance, of A exactly having X number of AY1 motifs. So what you do is that you take first this L minus N number of non-Y residues arbitrarily, so you get them replaced. And then you have basically L minus N plus one positions to place your Y residues first. And then there's this many way of placing it with replacement, because you could put multiple Y's at one slot. So you get this binomial distribution. And the next thing is that you place the X number of these M residues after where this Y will be placed. And that, you get this thing. And the multiplication, it turns out, you could simplify this, and it turns out to be a hypergeometric distribution. So we have to do a lot of this type of analysis. It's very difficult, this combinatorial analysis, because if you change K, you have to read everything. So the other way, so we have developed an analytical formula for k equals to 1 for multiple cases. And the other easier way, what Sinesse and Gerstein and Engelmann did, is that we just count, we just enumerate, exhaustively enumerate this thing. And that's not going to work if the length of the sequence is very long. But for stranded, you can still do it. And essentially, you just permute to these sequence of these residues, you count how often you see this A1 occasions, and then you calculate the probability. So one last technique detail is that how do you combine all this counting for individual strands when you have, say, 10,000 of these strands? So you use a dynamic programming method. So that's originally used by CNES. So it's very simple. You basically keep record when you have one strand and look at the second strand and just do summations of all possible ways until you get one, which come from 0, 1, or 1, 0, and so on and so forth. So you collect this, then you look at the next one. So you keep doing this, and this can be computed very quickly if this sequence is short. So here is a table of all the significant sequence motifs and anti-motifs we found using these sequences. So these are high propensities and these are low propensities. We need to clean up this data a little bit, but I don't expect a big changes for this. And let's look at those patterns with k equals to 2. And these patterns are probably most interesting. And they are essentially nearest neighbors in the strands that are in the same orientation, meaning either both facing inside or both facing outside. And it turns out that this AY2 motif is the most significant one, with a very strong p values. And what this means is quite interesting. You can see from N to C, you see this pattern appears a lot, an alanine, and then with another residue, and then you see tyrosines. But intriguingly, but if you reverse the order, YA2, and that's actually an unfavored anti-motif, also very significant p-values. And you can see similar results if you just restrict yourself with protein structures, not the genomic sequences. Of course, you have less data. This is less significant, but this pattern is the same. And this is very interesting in view of recent work by Chamberlain and Bowie, where they look at the tyrosines. They really find some very unique rotational preferences. And this pattern is general, actually. If you can replace alanine with valine, with glycine, and these patterns all have this interesting dichotomy. In one direction, it's favored, in the opposite direction, it's unfavored. And this is something.
In an opposite direction, are you actually taking into account that there are out strands and in strands?
Yeah, it's always
or
going
the direction.
No, just the N to C direction.
So you're assuming you're looking along the strand of the genome, but another possibility would be outside of the membrane or inside of the membrane.
No, it's strictly by N to C direction. It could be, say, this is facing. If you go N by N to C, this is facing inside of the
membrane. Right, but for the function of the protein, it doesn't care N to C, it just cares what's the outside of the
membrane. Right. So apparently, for this kind of pattern seems to be important. We don't know exactly why this is a cell. So you raise a very good question, why would it care about whether it's N to C? It only cares about the outside or inside. But that's not what we see. Actually, if it's up strand or down strand, you always see AY instead of YA. YA is actually disfavored, strongly disfavored. So this is kind of remarkable. We have no explanation, no good explanation. So the hope is some experimentalists might be willing to do this kind of mutations and studying the problem. So we can do the same thing for loop regions. So this cannot be done with this analytical model because it's just too long and too complicated. So we did it by enumerations, and exact p-value cannot be computed, but we have to play some heuristic model to approximate it. And this is interesting because if you look at experimental literature, and there are some motifs like aromatic X and aromatic or aromatic X and proline, and these are found by combinatorial peptide synthesis shown to be very important for chaperone binding to this protein. So it's important for folding. And it turns out that the only type of favorable motifs of aromatic X aromatic we found in these sequences are not located in the transmembrane region. They are in the loop regions. So this is this YF2 motif. And as others said, there's marginally favorable tryptophan and proline motif. So our hypothesis, so we're very good at generating hypothesis, we never can prove prove anything without experiments. But it will be, this might be the chaperone binding site. You make mutations, you might see some in vivo different patterns of photo. But we cannot prove this. So the significance of this study is that somehow, maybe we're ahead of our experimental colleagues. We already point some ways to do experiments. So depend on, so we believe the folding and assembly of these beta barrel membrane proteins depend on thermodynamics of lipids, proteins, and their interactions. And it will also help us to identify whether what patterns are important for the sorting and targeting process of these proteins in their ultimate destination in the cell. So we suggested some experiments. So first thing one should test is the outside positive rules. Can you make arginine lysine in periplasmic cap region and test the folding behavior? And can you reconstitute the lipid bilayers of different compositions of what you find out? And for folding, you could play with the aromatic rescues. So there are, for example, in this porine structure, there are three of these pairing motifs. If you change simultaneously, do you see unraveling of the proteins? Do you see basically unfolding of this protein? So that would be some interesting experiments. But the way why this is useful is that essentially this gives you some kind of empirical parameters. So you can then use this to study folding dynamics. You can basically look at how things fold using some models as we did with similarly with lattice model. Essentially, your space of folding is just this contact, whether there's a contact formed or not. So the number of conformations is actually manageable. So you can solve like master equations and so on and so forth. But I will not talk about that. But there's something we can do experimentally that is predicted the structures. So again, just to remind you, we have this fairly interesting patterns of the shape of the protein structures. So the first thing we do is that we want to see, given a particular sequence, can we predict the three-dimensional structures of these barrel proteins? So the first thing we need to do is basically predict the registration of adjacent strands, so in what locations they are interacting. And that's the first step. So the way we do this is to use these empirical parameters, what we call empirical potential functions. So there's the single body propensity. That's essentially the preference of residue in what particular regions. So we essentially thread the sequences through this a template of various positions in what regions with this energy score. And we find the best positions it should be for one strand. And then we add the second strand. Then we move around, basically evaluate the energy scores based on our parameters estimated. Then we can find what is the best position for those two strands to pair. So the energy score, it's totally empirical. There's no justification why these parameters are this way. But the way we put this together is that you have take this dyad unit, you have four residues. So they have one body potential, and then they have these pairwise interactions with the backbone hydrogen bond, side chain interactions, and the weak hydrogen bond. People know these parameters. But these weight functions are unknown. We don't know which relative importance of these interactions. And it turns out it's very interesting. So what we did is that we decided to use a leap one out test. So we develop a potential function by taking out this protein and look at the remaining 17 of them. Then we develop potential. Then we predict the structure of this one, the strand pairing. And then we tune these parameters, alpha 1, alpha 2. And we find that what is the set of parameters that makes least mistakes when I do this prediction experiment. And so we are somewhat quite successful in this. So if we don't know the strand starts, we are at an accuracy about 45%. And if we knew the strand starts, we are about 64%. And the best work done was by Jenny Thornton's group at EBI. I think they were at 31% or so. But the interesting is that you can look at the parameters, what's the best parameter you can choose, so you make least mistakes in the predictions. And it tells you something. It shows that the side chain interaction is probably the most important. And the hydrogen bonding interaction is also very important. And the weak hydrogen bond is not that important. So this tells you some physical features. And here's an example of ab initio prediction of this, the strand registration. So So we, all we need is take the sequences, and we are able to predict roughly, just look at the C alpha and what it should be. So that's not quite enough, because ultimately we really want to look at the atomic structures. We want to look at all the details of atomic atoms, and then maybe that can be used for further simulation studies. And the parameters for these pairing, essentially, essentially all we need to know is the pairing patterns of the strands. And some intermediate parameters are the number of strands and the shearing numbers. And the task is that if you are given only the strand pairing patterns, can you reconstruct a reliable three-dimensional structures at atomic levels? So the model we use is to use a coil-to-coil model. So in this case, essentially, we model the beta barrels with a major helix. And that's essentially how the beta strands twist around the vertical axis of the barrel. And then we also look at the miter helix. That's essentially how the backbone twists around itself. And each of these helix can be parameterized by three cylindrical coordinates. And then the atomic positions can be parameterized by six, essentially, coordinates. And here's the parameters here. Let me show you the coil. So this is the major coil around the axis of the barrel. And the minor coil is this thing around itself. So you have coordinates, this polar coordinates between z and r radius and the angle. And you have the same thing for this minor helix as well.
Why is it three parameters? I thought, you know, the Mahamran plot always had two angles in that.
Oh, there's a displacement. Where, how far away we're from the sea level. Yeah. So this goes back, if you cut these barrels out and you flatten them out. So there are constants that's applicable to all barrels. That's the distance between C alphas in this same strand and also the neighboring interstrand distance. This is a constant. And then for a constant describing a specific barrel is this number of strands and also the shearing number that we discussed earlier. And then with that, then we can derive what is the radius of the barrel and what is the tilt angle and so on and so forth. So with that, then we can construct basically the coordinates of where you should place all of your atoms. And this is what you can do. So if you know the pairing patterns, you can basically compute, place all the C alpha atoms, these are colored in red, and you can also place those C alpha that's facing outside, and these are colored in green. And then you can look at the backbone, the remaining backbone atoms here, as well as C beta atoms, such shown in black colors. And with that, we can actually predict the atomic structures. And this is the ab initio. All we know is sequences we can predict through this level. So one of them is native, one of them is predicting structure. And they are actually quite good. The RMSD is about 2.4 angstroms.
You start with just the sequence.
That's all.
Straight in, and then your simulation you have it straight, and then this thing actually folds.
No, I don't do any simulation, I just predict the structure.
You predict the structure, yeah.
Okay. But I do use this work by Bernhard Rost. They are HMM models to predict where the strands are located. And I take that as my input.
The other input is the relative probabilities that we measured in the first part of the talk.
Exactly.
Like this and this and this. And then you just basically find a structure that optimizes all that.
Yeah.
So that's like most likely.
Yeah. The optimal or with lowest energy, empirical energy at this point. Yeah. So we're not completely successful because it's still very hard to predict the strand pairing. We're only at 60% accuracy. But if we think ahead of ourselves, suppose we solve that problem, if we know all the strand pairing, and then we can basically predict all the atomic structures at a very good resolution. So these are non-trivial, I mean, 100 and sometimes 200 some residues. You can get 3 angstrom RMSD for atomic structures if we just look at backbone atoms and C beta. So the side chains is another problem we plan to solve. But these parameters of Rotemers and pairing patterns, I think, will be of great help for us. So in conclusion, I think I ran over time, or is
there?
No, I have not. Okay.
Yeah, so do you think this may work just going even farther with DNA sequences, you know?
Yeah, DNA you can translate them into residue sequences.
Yeah.
Then you put that sequence into Burkhard Rosler's HNN model for predicting strengths. And then we use that output to predict.
So that's very good. Now we may know what all those sequences.
Yeah, but
all about
it's not solved yet. We're only at 60% accuracy.
Yeah.
That's the caveat. But we're working on this. So in conclusion for this part of the talk about beta barrel membrane proteins, so essentially we have estimated these regional preferences of residues, and that will help us to discover the chemical code for essentially membrane insertions of these membrane proteins. And we also find out the strand pairing preferences, and there are some very interesting patterns of aromatic rescues and stabilizing interactions, and it will help us to predict the strand pairing. And very interestingly are these sequence motifs. What is this dichotomy of AY2? Most people have no idea, and that's very intriguing. I think the signal is so strong, it must be playing some roles. So there are two possibilities. They might be important for folding thermodynamically, or they might be important for the cellular machinery to recognize it, to sort it and target it. We don't know. Then we showed that you can predict the atomic structures if you know the pairing. So for the remaining part of the talk, I will go over some recent results and some maybe not so recent results on helical membrane proteins. So you can see these are a lot of a number of helical structures that have been solved. So we studied the packing of these helices, and particularly what we were interested in, if you look at these interhelical interactions, kind of pairwise and higher order and so on and so forth. One thing we found is that if you look at helical proteins, it's much, much more complicated. And the reason is because you can lay out the transmembrane helices. And if you look at three-dimensional structures, it's not just the sequence neighbors that interact. You can see these red interactions, they all have some kind of interactions, but they are non-sequence neighbors. So this is really hard.
So that should be tilted with respect to each other.
Yeah, there's tilt, and there's angle, there's a kink, and all this stuff is so complicated. But what we did is we developed these parameters of the pairing preferences of these residues across the places. And one thing emerges that in many cases you see most of these transmembrane helices have some kind of hydrogen bond. Almost all interacting helix pairs, they have hydrogen bond interactions. The exceptions are, so there are three exceptions. One of them is actually low resolution structures. And it turns out that these helical pairs, if they have hydrogen bonds, they are much tighter than the others. And we essentially carry the same modeling approach. We found some spatial motifs that since being validated by experimentalists. So we basically published our paper, and people were interested enough to do experiments. And one of them is serine zippers. You can see there's a serine pairing, and they form strong interactions to hold the helices together. And the other one is this polar clamps. So you have a aromatic, you have like asparagine and glutamine residues. And there's two residues that clamp on this one residue. It's a very common motifs. And they are important not only for the interactions of one protein, but also for these subunit interactions between membrane proteins. So the recent work we're interested in, we did is to look at how helix interact with lipid environments using the approach of looking at the known structures, because there's a lot of information there. The question we want to ask is that how do you identify the lipid-facing surfaces of a particular helices when you only know the sequencing, nothing else? Can you do that? So what are the lipid-facing surfaces? So this is based on our work on these structures. So essentially what we do is we use a probe of 1.9 angstrom. We roll this around the structure of the protein, and we look for wherever it's approachable from the outside. We define those residues are the lipid-facing residues. And we use this method I participated in developing some time ago. So it's a very similar idea. It's again this statistical model, except we look at residue-specific preference of interacting with lipids. So there was some work done by Nir Bantal some time ago. Basically, they looked at genomic sequences, and it's early studies. So we did this work in a collaboration with Bill DeGuado, and we developed this scale. So that is a very useful parameter for us to see whether this residue is favorable or phasmidic. But very importantly, actually, you can learn a lot from evolutionary patterns of these sequences. So there's a very nice observation made by Arkin and Steven some time ago. What they saw is that the core regions of the proteins are usually more conserved than those regions that are facing lipids. So what we did is that because we want just to work with sequences, so we make an assumption that it takes this standard heptad shape of a helix. So essentially, we take each individual helix, we can build a canonical surface model of seven surfaces. So our problem then can be simplified as to, can you identify among the seven surfaces which one is lipid facing? So that's our problem. And we did some work to show that this heptad model works quite well for most of the helices. So the parameter we added in addition to the lipid propensity is these evolutionary information. So that's essentially calculating the empirical Shannon entropy of sequences once you have a multiple sequence alignment. So this is the kind of thing you get. So essentially, we take, for example, bacterial rhodopsins. We look at transmembrane one, and then there's seven canonical faces, and we calculate its, for example, entropy, and then we can look at on the x-axis what is the probe accessible area, which is basically lipid accessibility, and you can see there's very nice correlations for the lipid exposure versus the entropy. So we use this method to develop the empirical scoring function that is simple, basically summation of the entropy contribution as well as the empirical thermodynamic contribution. And you can see, we can look at, for this particular protein, we can identify the face. This is the face that's facing lipid, and indeed it is. This is for transmembrane helix one. But helix two is very interesting because there is it's going through this one side and then sticking out on the other side of the protein, and we can also so all helices we are able to predict. So this is another example of bovine rhodopsin. So given just the sequences, we predicted that these are the residues facing lipid, and these are the residues facing should be buried. So that we did this for every one of them. So we used this leap one now to test because the number of structures is still small. So the overall accuracy is about 91% or 92%. So it works really well. So the idea is that if you give me a biological sequence, transmembrane helix, 91% of the time I can tell you which is the lipid facing part. And I can also, we recently published a paper that there are cases in the genome you look for, there's a huge transmembrane proteins with 20 helices, so some of them will be buried. We can also tell you which helices are completely buried using this approach. And furthermore, we can use actually to help experimentalists. So here, if you look at the structure of cytochrome B6F complexes, so this structure was solved twice by two different groups for different species. But if you look at their assignment, the overall structures are quite similar. But the assignment of these strands are different. For example, in one structure, the pattern N subunit is assigned here, but it's assigned for the other structure on the other side. So which one is correct? So we use these lipid propensity calculations and entropy calculations. We have a strong opinion that this one is wrong, probably. It's very likely wrong, but there's no way we can verify, but we can just suggest that people should check this more carefully. So in summary of this part of the talk, basically we looked at helix and helix interactions, and we can identify a lot of interesting spatial patterns. And we can also solve the problem, basically, the interface, determining the interface of helix-lipid interactions if you give me biological sequences. And we can also predict buried helices with a good accuracy. So this is a collaboration with a graduate student, Jacob, who's an MD-PhD student, and postdoc, Larissa Adena, who has worked with me for a long time. And also the lipid propensity work is a collaboration with Gilbert Rado's lab, and I'll be happy to.